May it please the court. I'm David Nakashima for the Discovery Bay and Admiral Thomas appellants. As you may recall, in the first Matsudo appeal, the district court improperly deferred to the city council's discretion under the reserve powers doctrine. That was reversed. Now, 30 months later, we're back in front of you. It's a different verse of the same song. The district court again deferred to the city council and ruled against my clients.
Before you proceed, let me just ask you a preliminary question. You're representing both groups of plaintiffs, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
From the Admiral Thomas and the Discovery. Now, as far and they come up from different judgments from different district judges. Now, as far as the issues that we have to deal with are concerned, is it your position that there's nothing to distinguish these cases from each other? Is that right?
I think there are some factual distinctions that I'll get into, but the fundamental decision by both Judge Ezra and Judge Sebra, I believe, were very similar, and we are appealing.
As to the legal issue?
Correct.
Yeah, right. All right, so if we get to any point where you think it does make a difference, you'll call our attention to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, fine, thank you.
Very well.
Mr. Nakashima, before I proceed, can I understand something as well? Chapter 38 was incorporated by reference into your documentation, was it not?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
And as part of the documentation, paragraphs 4.A and section 3 indicate that the agreement was expressly conditioned upon the city's successful acquisition of the property through the exercise of the power of eminent domain, and that the failure of the city to acquire the property through no fault of the buyer will render this contract null and void without further action by either the buyer or the city. And secondly, in paragraph 3, the buyer further assumes the risk of all changes in zoning, land use, ordinances, rules, regulations, and adverse governmental actions of any kind that may affect the property or the buyer's intended use of the property. And I know that your position is that there's kind of an implied covenant in here, but before we get to that, I want to understand, in light of that language, is it fair to say that the city and county of Honolulu did not guarantee to your clients that the property would be condemned?
I agree, Your Honor, that there was no guarantee under the contract.
And is there any evidence in the record of bad faith on the part of the city or the county?
Close, but I don't think so. But I don't think that's the U.S. Trust case. The second point I would make, Your Honor, on that second provision, first of all, I think they've characterized it, the city, as the assumption of risk. But if you read that provision, it's really post-closing assumption of risk relating to the lessee's use of the property. It had nothing to do with the foundational questions.
But didn't the ordinance itself, though, call out these issues?
Yes, it did. And that's the second point, is there were certain administrative legislative steps that had to be completed. And we're not disputing that, Your Honor. But our point is, under the U.S. Trust case, there does have to be a heightened scrutiny where you're involving a city contract and city legislation that essentially negated or vitiated that contract.
Do you agree that the city and county could not have constitutionally delegated to your clients collectively the power of eminent domain?
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel, I gather both Judge Sebright and Judge Ezra, in their respective decisions, applied U.S. Trust. And obviously you disagree with how they did it, but they were purporting to apply U.S. Trust.
Purporting, I think, okay, is the operative word here. Because what happened is, particularly with Judge Sebright, whose decision came out first, he conflated all three prongs of the U.S. Trust case in finding no impairment simply because the contracts contemplated the use of eminent domain and the legislative discretion. The problem with that is the court did not go on to do the analysis of whether there was a significant and legitimate public purpose served by the repeal ordinance, and whether the impairment was both reasonable and necessary.
Well, you have to reach those, I'll call them the later prongs of U.S. Trust, if the court correctly found that your clients didn't meet the first prong, or your case did not meet the first prong. Isn't that the end of the case? Why does he have to go on and, you know, make a finding on the other two prongs?
Well, I think in this case, the court was required to, because let me give you the situation. Let's take it even stronger for the city. But the contract said, this contract is subject to the discretion of the city council in determining public purpose. And let's assume the city council says there is no public purpose, but that their motive and their basis was either malicious or it was unfounded. They just made a conclusion that there was no public purpose. The court still has to go through the analysis to see whether that finding in a constitutional contract clause case, whether that was reasonable, whether it was necessary, whether it was significant, all those things that were set forth. And the problem is, facially here, the district courts simply just said, no impairment, we don't have to go any further. I would also bring up another scenario, because if you follow the district court's rulings, all the court counsel will be doing in the future is embedding in each contract that it makes with any vendor or with any citizen, they'll just put in subject to legislative discretion. And then later, if the city council or the administration decides, you know, we don't want to fulfill this contract, we'll just, in our discretion, decide it's not worthwhile. If you follow the district court's ruling to a logical extreme, that ends the inquiry, and that ends any...
Counsel, with respect, aren't you overstating your case there? I mean, if you look at Southern California Gas versus City of Santa Ana, our court made clear that if there was a guarantee, that's a different matter, because then the city and county would be as bound by the contract as any private party would. But the reality is here, if I understand your argument correctly, you've conceded that the city and county cannot, in effect, delegate away its police powers. It cannot delegate away the concept of declaring whether there is a public use here. That's a legislative political power that they have. In this case, on the one extreme, you've got the Southern California gas case. On the other extreme, you've got the RUI cases. You've got the Tahoe case and others where, in other jurisdictions, admittedly, you have governmental entities that have made changes where there's been no finding of bad faith, and that's why I asked you that question before. And the court has consistently said that those are police powers, that they have the right to do those things. And although there may be an indirect impact, the reality is the repeal of Chapter 38 involved more than just your clients. It involved a whole lot of people. And if I understand your perspective, anybody who was somewhere in the pipeline was just protected from the get-go. Am I misunderstanding you?
Protected to a degree that they are afforded the constitutional right to have the district court analyze whether the impairment was significant or reasonable.
And do you have any case law that suggests, following up on Judge Tashima's question, any case law that suggests that once the court has made the initial determination of the three prongs and the sub-prongs for that matter, that it needs to go any further if it finds that the first prong is not satisfied?
In a government contract case?
Correct.
There's a distinction between
private
contract.
Government contract case, yeah.
No, because in every case we found, the court continued with its analysis to determine whether the government legislation was in fact reasonable and necessary.
If there is a case that says the first prong is all you have to do, do you lose?
In Allied Structural Steel, it said that in dicta, that this is the preliminary step and you can stop there. But if you look at the actual ruling in Allied Structural Steel, The court went on to address each one of the three prongs, but it did state you can stop. The problem here, though, is the district court did stop without, and I hate to use the word, getting their hands dirty and looking at what happened here. And I'll give you another example. In Admiral Thomas, groups 1 and 2, the city council did find public purpose, but in group 3, because of the repeal ordinance, it did not. And we have this anomalous situation where for, I think it's Ms. Nakamura, who was in group 1, there was a public purpose, but for Mr. and Mrs. Clothier that lived on the same floor, in the same building, at the same time, but was in group 3, what the district court is saying is there's no public purpose for you. And, you know, that type of...
What's the difference between that and somebody that buys a cash for clunker's car on day one and on the day after it expired, they've got to buy our car and say, hey, I want my cash. What's the difference? Why can't Congress do that? Why can't a city and county do that?
The city can, but it has to justify why it's going to cut off the cash for clunkers.
Didn't it give us space and say, you know, here's this period of time, and everybody that completes all the requirements before this date's okay. After that, no. There's due process there, isn't there?
No, there isn't, because they did not follow the court. The district court didn't do the evaluation. Was there a less onerous or less punitive way of cutting off the line? Was it reasonable? If you look at the repeal ordinance itself and the finding of no public purpose, it was of degree not kind. It said the social and economic conditions were to a lesser extent than it was back in 1991. And I think both in Cayetano, Southern California Gas, and U.S. Trust, where the change is in degree not kind, that is not reasonable.
Now, Councilman, you're down to about 2.5 minutes. You can use your time or you can reserve whatever you'd like.
I'm reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You're down to 2.5, I'm sorry. So if you want to save rebuttal, I think you better do it now.
I better do that.
Yes.
Thank you for allowing me. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. You'll have some rebuttal time.
May it please the court. My name is Don Kitaoka. With me today is Brad Saito and Kyle Chang. We're all deputy corporation counsels for the city and county of Honolulu. So good morning and aloha, as we say.
Aloha, aloha.
The whole point of this case is whether, in fact, the first prong of the three-prong test of U.S. trust has been met or not. And both courts, two courts independently in two independent cases, found that there was no impairment and ruled as such. This court has pointed out that Chapter 38 and its corresponding rules were explicitly incorporated into the contracts, and therefore it set forth the process in which these lessees could obtain their lease fee interest. And that process was a number of steps and a number of requirements. Applicants must establish their qualifications. They have to keep up their numbers. There must be a public hearing. Department of Community Services must make a determination of an effectuation of a public purpose. And most importantly, the adoption by the City Council of a resolution providing for the acquisition of the lease fee interest through condemnation was in fact the final necessary step that needed to take place before these lessees could say that they had a so-called right to receive their...
In group 3, they didn't get such a resolution, but the first two groups, and I think it was in the Admiral Thomas leases, if I'm correct, they did get a resolution.
That's right.
Does the fact that the circuit court, the Hawaiian Circuit Court, concluded that there weren't 25 people who qualified, is that the bete noire of the piece in this one?
As far as Admiral Thomas is concerned, and this is where it becomes ironic, because in Admiral Thomas, the city was standing hand in hand with the lessees, trying their best to get the lease fee interest for the lessees. They went through condemnation proceeding. It got dismissed. They went through the appeal. That got reversed. It went back to court with the lessees to try to get their condemnation. So the city, in fact, was trying to argue for these condemnation conversions.
I thought you agreed that they didn't have the 25. You're suggesting
I'm agreeing that the court, the state court, found that they didn't have the 25.
Well, I understand that, but what the city's position in the state court that they didn't have 25?
The city was always of the position that we were arguing that their numbers should have been kept up, or that the numbers were up and therefore satisfied the qualifications.
Yeah, my point, though, is that you're not representing to the court, are you, that the city was there cheering for these folks and hoping that they would have 25?
Yes.
Is that what the record shows?
The record shows that the city was representing the lessees and was arguing to the state court that, in fact, that they had adequate numbers.
By the way, isn't there still an appeal pending in that case?
I believe so, Your Honor.
What's the status now of the appeal?
The status of that appeal is that there needs to be a decision of whether, in fact, the dismissal of the Admiral Thomas lessee case, whether that was correct or not.
Now, if that's reversed, and the city's position being what it is, you can go ahead with the condemnation and Admiral Thomas on behalf of Groups 1 and 2, right?
As to Groups 1 and 2, that's absolutely correct.
But not Group 3.
Not Group 3. Group 3 never got a resolution from the city council that...
Well, let me ask this. If you go ahead, you know, if there's a state appellate reversal in that case, if you go ahead with Group 1 and 2, you know, why not include Group 3?
Because there was a point in time...
What's the purpose of excluding Group 3 under those circumstances?
Well, for one thing, I don't believe Group 3 was ever given the opportunity to find a public purpose, because the law was...
My question is this. How can a city justify finding a public, you know, in the same condominium complex, how can the city justify finding a public surface with respect to Groups 1 and 2, but not Group 3? They're in the same building.
The justification is that the city council, or the present city council, found that all of the reasons
I don't know what they found, but the question is, how do you justify that?
The justification is that at one point in time, the city council found that there is no longer a public purpose to mandatory leasehold conversion. The concept of mandatory leasehold conversion was cut off by the present city council, well, not even the present city council, the council in 2005, because they found that there were no longer the social ills that were associated with the necessity for the mandatory leasehold conversion law. So there is a point in time when the city council found that there was no public purpose because there was no social ills to be corrected at that time. Counselor, and from that point on, the light on leasehold conversion was turned off.
Council, following up on Judge Tshima's question, help me figure this out. If the state Supreme Court reverses, what will the impact of that be so far as the city's condemnation plans are concerned?
The condemnation plans for Groups 1 and 2, the city will continue to support those groups if, in fact, they're allowed to continue in the process. That process has commenced. That process was appealed. It was reversed. That process still goes on.
Well, does the city feel bound to exercise its right of eminent domain? Is that what you're telling us?
The city council and for Groups 1 and 2 has already found that those units were subject to a public purpose for mandatory leasehold conversion. Therefore, the city will stick to that decision that a prior city council has made, because there is a specific savings clause within the repeal clause that said that if, in fact, any unit already received a condemnation resolution that they, in fact, were grandfathered in. So with respect to groups 1 and 2 of Admiral Thomas, those units were clearly grandfathered in, and the city will stick to that decision.
When was the decision made by the city to condemn the units for groups 1 and 2?
Early on.
What year, roughly? 1996, 97, 2000?
I would say in the early 2000s.
Early 2000s. Okay. Will I find that in the record?
The reason I'm confused with the dates is because there's several designations and two amendments to the complaints in the Admiral Thomas case. Mm-hmm. It commenced, and then there were add-ons, and then there were second add-ons.
But what I'm trying to look for is, what is the date upon which the city actually exercised its power of eminent domain to condemn these units for 1 and 2?
That is found in the Sherman case. Which is, in fact, a Supreme Court decision. I believe it was 2004, and the record will show that.
So in 2004, the city determined there was a public purpose to condemn these units for 1 and 2, but as to group 3, it passed the repeal of Chapter 38, in which case, within what, less than a year or about a year, they changed their mind?
Well, in effect, while the dismissal of the state court case was on appeal, that's when the repeal of Chapter 38 happened. So in fact, that case had already gone to state court and had been dismissed and then appealed, and at that time, the repeal happened. So
help me with this one particular factual point. You tell me that the city committed to condemn in 2004 for 1 and 2, but then passed the repeal in what, 2005?
That's correct.
Is there anything in the record which would explain why the city made such a quick turnaround?
Well, there may have been new council members, for one thing. But the second thing is that there was a specific finding through testimony of the public and in the consideration of Bill 53 for the repeal that the City Council based its finding that there was no longer a public purpose to mandatory leasehold conversion. Mandatory leasehold conversion had been in effect for, say, 10 years. In which hundreds and thousands of condominium units were mandatorily converted or converted through negotiations in light of this mandatory conversion law. And so by the time that the year 2005 came about, most of the units that were applying for condominium conversion, in fact, were either successful in doing it or negotiated an acquisition.
I'd like to follow up on the questions of my colleagues in terms of the impact of this case in light of the ongoing circuit case. If the Court of Appeal in Hawaii reverses the lower circuit court decision and sends it back and says there were 25 or more applicants ongoing, what impact, if any, does this case have on that determination, or would it go separately?
It would have no impact whatsoever on groups 1 and 2.
Okay, and now let's reverse it. Let's assume for a moment that the Court of Appeals said no, the Hawaiian Circuit Court was correct. There were never 25 people. What impact, if any, does that have on this case?
This case would have no impact on that decision either, because they would have tried to go through under the former Chapter 38 and failed to maintain one of their requirements, those myriad of requirements that I set forth, one of them was that you had to keep your numbers up. And so, and therefore, under the old law, Chapter 38, which is in effect for groups 1 and 2, they would have failed to qualify.
So for our purposes, as we consider the constitutional arguments made by opposing counsel, should we consider at all the ongoing circuit court litigation?
You should not consider the circuit court litigation at all in your deliberation.
It doesn't moot anything.
Let me ask this question, Mr. Kitaoka. If, I don't know who's hearing it, the ICA or the Supreme Court? Is it before Supreme Court? ICA?
ICA.
All right, if the ICA says, affirms the trial court decision, right? That, you know, there weren't enough applicants in groups 1 and 2.
Right.
That means there's an independent reason that groups 1 and 2 aren't eligible to have their leaseholds converted to fee interest, right?
Absolutely.
So doesn't that make the constitutional issue moot because they're not qualified anyway?
If I can articulate, and I hesitate to do this, articulate their argument, it's basically that because they weren't able to put in the three extra units, that's why they weren't able to keep their numbers up, and that's how they're linking together the their present groups 1 and 2 and group 3. They're saying the failure to have group 3 added on, group 3 would have kept their numbers up.
All right. From your perspective, this case is simply a backstop on the part of the plaintiffs who have thus far been unsuccessful in their litigation in the state court.
It may be a backstop for them, but it is a principle for us at the city that, in fact, the repeal of Chapter 38 was done in a proper manner, was done with a savings clause that designated a proper dividing line for grandfathering in cases, and in fact had no impairment whatsoever on the present contracts, because those contracts specifically contemplated the fact that the city council was going to exercise its discretion in making a determination of whether in fact there was a public purpose that supported the condemnation. There was never an assumption or guarantee, as this court put it, that they would achieve that goal. That goal was always subject to the reserved right of the city council to make that public purpose determination, and only the city council could make that public purpose determination. So it was expressed, and it was in fact contemplated by the parties that the city council would have that decision-making power.
Does the best efforts clause apply to the city's consideration of whether or not to exercise their eminent domain powers?
The best efforts clause applies to the entire effort by the city to achieve condemnation conversion, but it did not include the city's city council's discretion in determining whether there was a public purpose.
The city council a part of the city?
The city, the legislative body of the city, but the contract specifically reserved.
But the city and county of Honolulu includes the legislative branch, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, then, isn't the legislative branch bound to exercise its best efforts?
Its best efforts in making a good faith determination, Your Honor, but not a determination that would go against their public purpose finding of whether, in fact, condemnation was justified.
Thank you very much, Counsel. Your time has expired. Mr. Nakashima, you have some reserve time.
Just, I think the best way to kind of crystallize this is to look at two inconsistencies. The first is one that the court noted about Admiral Thomas. Judge O'Scanlan, the condemnation suit was filed in 203 for Group 1. Group 2 was found and added to that lawsuit in 204. The repeal ordinance was first introduced in 204 and passed in January 205. So we're talking a very short period of time here. But we do have this inconsistency where all of a sudden lessees in groups 1 and 2 can proceed and there is a public purpose, and for group 3 there is not.
Is it your position that as long as a group is part of the same condominium project, that the city has no constitutional right to make any distinctions among lessees?
No, it certainly does if the lessee does not have qualifications or own real other
What's
real
What's the property. Difference between that and a timing issue?
Well,
they say you got to have a certain number, you can't own real property elsewhere and so on, and you got to do it by this date. And if you don't do it by this date, you're out of luck. What's the difference?
Well, because it was done prospectively where they decide my clients have already signed their contracts and proceeding group 3. Mm-hmm. And then they say, you're cut off.
But they hadn't finished complying, though, right? Let's just say, for example, that you've got a bunch of your clients that have signed up to buy houses, but they haven't got any financing.
Right.
And somebody said, if you haven't got this deal closed by this date, it's all going into bankruptcy and it's going to be sold to somebody else. What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that, Your Honor. But under the U.S. trust case, if it's a government contract and it's the government that passes a law that impairs that contract, you have to go through the analysis.
Well, let me ask you, in this case, people who might, you know, want to take advantage of this program, were they given like some kind of prospective notice? In other words, if you want to be eligible for condemnation, you have to, you know, get your stuff to the city, you know, by such and such a date because the city council is going to repeal this ordinance or anything like that?
There was no
There was no prospective notice.
Correct.
It was just done, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, the ordinance was introduced and it was just, you know, this is what it is. The second inconsistency I would ask you to look at is Judge Seabright's footnote 5, which addresses this court's footnote 7. In the court's footnote 7, you say it wasn't clear whether the repeal was foreseen or incorporated in the contract, but the city is still bound by the best efforts clause. In response, you look at Judge Seabright's decision, footnote 5, he says, oh, it's not the no finding of public purpose in the repeal ordinance I'm relying upon, it's the finding of public purpose for the specific condemnation actions. So he tries to skirt around this court's footnote 7 in his footnote 5. But if you read the next, go back up into the text, he then says, I find there is no public purpose under the repeal ordinance. So I think it's a bit disingenuous to go between two different public purposes, kind of the broad one for the repeal.
Counsel, you have run out of time, but I want to ask you the same question we asked Mr. Kitaoka, and that is, do you agree that if the Intermediate Court of Appeals affirms the Circuit Court, then that's the end of that claim?
In state court.
In
the federal court, Mr. Kitaoka is correct. Our whole position is, had Group 3 in Admiral Thomas been approved or given the same grandfathering that Groups 1 and 2, we would have had sufficient numbers. Now, we can't go back in state court and say, but for, you know, the city's repeal ordinance, but we still do have a constitutional claim of impairment because they made the arbitrary decision to cut it off and not allow Group 3, which was similarly situated.
Was that in order to achieve the numbers? Is that why you're making that argument?
Correct, because the circuit court found, I think we only had 22
right.
out of 25. Had we had Group 3 in there, as
I'm not sure I understand your position correctly. It's the city and county's position that what happens in our court is somewhat irrelevant to what happens in the state court, and that this would not necessarily be mooted. But on the other hand, if the whole purpose of your litigation here is to get the numbers up, because without the numbers everybody agrees you can't move forward, then if the state court decides that the numbers aren't there, why doesn't that moot out whatever we'd be doing?
I think that's what the city may argue. My point,
well, isn't that the fact?
No, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because our constitutional claim putting aside the state court action, let's assume it's been dismissed and affirmed.
But you, with respect, counsel, you, as I understand it now, you're saying that your constitutional claim is that they didn't let you aggregate the numbers from the third group to the previous two groups in order to have 25.
Correct.
And yet that is not the main thrust of the paperwork we have. The paperwork seems to be arguing a quite different point, which is that as to the first two groups, certainly, they didn't get through, and because the city has a best efforts requirement, they can't stop this procedure now. They got to let it go forward, and group three kind of is off to the side. Now it seems like group three and the numbers represented by group three go to the heart of your claim. Am I missing something?
And I apologize, Your Honor. I don't think I've been very clear. It is the heart of the claim on the constitutional claim in federal court. Regardless if the case is the state court action, let's assume one hypothetical, it's reversed. Groups one and two will go forward, and, you know.
Go forward to do what? They don't have the numbers. If the state court.
No, but the appeal was. The state court appeal is that we did have the numbers because we believe the trial court erred. And we would go forward with that condemnation action. Even though Chapter 38's been repealed, it still comes within the grandfather.
Well, the city says that's true. That's true also.
Right.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and the court will adjourn.
Thank you, Your Honor.